Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or on your Times Radio app. Thank you, Hugo Rifkin, for looking after the place yesterday on the bank holiday. Don't worry, that is now all of my holiday, I think, until the end of November. So, I mean, right the way through, we've got party conferences and Cheltenham and all of that. In fact, you can come and see us live. We're doing the show live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. You can get tickets to see us. We are going to be discussing the upcoming election. What year is it, is the question we're asking. Is it 97? Is it 92? Is it 74? Is it, I don't know, 1911? We've got a great panel for the Times Radio debate. We've got Aisha Hazarika, Kate McCann, Patrick Maguire and John Curtis. If you want to come and see us live, it's mid-October, Friday the 13th of October. Just search Cheltenham Literature Festival and you can get tickets online right there. Right, coming up on today's episode, our fantastic series continues, Political Editors. Today we reach, what is it, 2013? Frances Elliott becomes political editor smack bang in the middle of the coalition and he covers from the coalition to COVID with a whole load of Brexit in between. It's a lot of fun. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as ever, let's take a look at the day's news with today's columnists.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
And as it's Tuesday, we say a very good morning to Times columnist Danny Finkelstein. Hello, Danny.
Hello, Matt.
And I'd like to be joined by Miranda Green, Deputy Opinion Editor at the Financial Times. Hello, Miranda.
Hello, Matt.
Now, somebody's been in touch saying they're very excited that you're both here. Brings back memories of the great This Week with Andrew Neil. I mean, there's Alistair and Scotland. I'm not comparing myself to Andrew Neil, of course. I haven't got the hair for it, but it's nice. You two are long-standing sparring partners.
Well, sparring.
Actually, we
I wouldn't dare spar with Danny. You know, I just sort of, I just try to control my face as his wise words drop forth. You know.
Very good. What were you going to say, Danny?
Well, we were together on Newsnight quite a bit rather than on This Week. Miranda was really the star of This Week, and we did a fair bit of Newsnight together, where we talked about Liberal Democrats and Conservatives, and also Gordon Brown. I don't know whether you remember, Miranda, but I kind of ran out of ways in which Gordon Brown could win a general election, and each week I was asked to come on and kind of give some sort of nuanced explanation of what his strategy should be, and I realised there was actually no longer a strategy, no longer a problem. It was quite difficult because I didn't want to appear like, you know, the stereotypical Tory saying there was no chance for him, but I just couldn't intellectually work it out.
They were great days. I remember them very fondly. I do remember one night where we were right at the end of the show on Newsnight, and Danny was forced to justify the fact that his eyes were closed while I was speaking, that he was thinking about what I was saying rather than it was just all very late and I was being incredibly dull. So I hope not to do that today, then.
Well, that is true. David Owen did once fall asleep on television while Geoffrey Howe was speaking and only woke up when Jonathan Dimbleby said to him, "What do you make of that, David Owen?"
And that's fabulous. He
replied, "That I don't think that's the real issue, Jonathan."
Well, I was saying, well, we'll keep an eye on you. Are both on the Zoom. I'm pleased to see that both of you you have got something in common. Neither of you felt the need to tidy up before coming on the Zoom this morning.
Thanks, Matt.
I was very relieved when I saw. I did actually tidy up because I, in fact, previously had a very large bag of Chelsea kit, which I removed specially. So
is that your job? Done. Do you have to wash it, Daddy? Is that your job at Chelsea?
So I washed off all of our sponsorship logo.
Oh, very good. Right, let's get on and talk about politics then. To some extent, maybe it's a rerun of the conversation about whether or not there is a route back for Gordon Brown, Danny. Is there a route back for Rishi Sunak? On the front of the Times today, polling shows that Labour now has sustained leads over the Conservatives on issues that you'd normally expect the Conservatives to be strong on. Immigration and asylum, law and order, tax. Now, to some extent, it's because the Tories have collapsed and Labour sort of bumping along where they were. Is there anything that we can read into that about a route back for the Conservatives, Danny?
Yeah, I think it's obvious that the chances of a Conservative majority in the next election are really, really small. And it is difficult to think of what the advice you'd offer them to put themselves in a position to win that majority. So I've actually not done that. I've started to say, well, look, what can the Conservative Party do two things? One, which is their responsibility as a party to govern the country as well as they possibly can in the time remaining to them. And secondly, to find a way of minimising any losses that they might get in an election. I think that's a better way to think of it, because if, for example, you do what John Major did, and I was working for him then, you decide you're going to hold out to see whether there's a moment where you can retain power, you can often make the situation worse. So it may be, in the Conservative Party's case, that two things come to their rescue compared to their current opinion poll position. One is the economy, and the second is lack of enthusiasm for Keir Starmer, despite the fact that I think he's doing strategically the right things to reduce fear of Labour. Those two things can reduce the Conservative Party's deficit. I think it's a small chance that it'll be enough to ensure the party wins the general election. But fortunately, governing in the national interest and electoral strategy come together. They are, in fact, the one thing is what you would give them to as advice to the to do the other.
Miranda, the one thing that struck me about the immigration thing is that immigration and asylum is the thing that the Conservative government, particularly under Rishi Sunak, with Stop the Boats and all that, have really put up in lights. Is that, you know, they've embraced the problem, they've told everyone in the country that it is a massive problem, and yet the more they bang on about it, the worse their ratings on this issue seems to get.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, over the summer, when they had this slightly bizarre strategy of having a week on each of their five pledges, The week that was supposed to be, look at what we're doing on immigration, look at what we're doing to, in their words, stop the boats, was such a disaster, because what it actually showed that they weren't stopping the boats and they didn't have a grip on the illegal immigration situation at all. That then bled over across into the next week, which was supposed to be their NHS-themed week. You know, so in fact, the problem that they've got is they've highlighted this issue which is almost unmanageable, and in which almost all the indicators are going completely in the wrong direction. And that leads to a feeling of the opposite of what Danny's talking about. You know, this idea of governing in the national interest, demonstrating lack of grip on something that you've chosen to highlight is really not the way to show that you can at least, you know, be competent and therefore go on to minimise those losses at the election, which is, I absolutely agree with Danny, that's what the game is for Sunak. So I think particularly on that immigration topic, as you say, it's extremely interesting to see that polling this morning. And also, you know, Labour is very, very comfortably ahead on the areas where you would expect them to be and where they historically are, like health and education. But lots of these other policy areas, including immigration, the Tories do not have a lead. The only place where they do have a lead, interestingly, is defence and security. I don't know how much one can put that down to the Ukraine crisis and the fact that the government's been very sort of staunch on NATO and an alliance against Moscow on that. I don't know what Danny thinks about that. I mean, Keir Starmer does try to play up the kind of Labour patriotism angle from time to time. But it's interesting that that one policy area is still a strength for the Tories' defence.
Yeah, I think that the Labour Party's decision is about whether or not it thinks the economy will be a strong issue for it in next year or not. If not, then they do need to select an issue to refight the campaign on, not hop around from one issue to another. The NHS is usually a very good issue for Labour. If the salience to the NHS is high, it usually favours Labour. It may be that they just do a broad sweep of time for a change as an issue. But what Ed Miliband did is it came to the election in 2015. He kept hopping from one issue to another. So it was tax evasion 1 week, and it was the NHS the next week, and it was rich people the week after. And they didn't settle on an issue. And, you know, most of the political science says you should run on the economy if you can. That's the strongest issue. And if you can't run on the economy, you have to have another issue. This is the reason why some Tories think, you know, the best issue for them will be the ECHR, which I happen to think will not be a great issue because I think it would split the Conservative Party. And I don't think enough people will be on their side. But that's the reason why there's talk of that. But my view is, you know, the Conservative Party can either run on the economy or it won't be able to win a general election. If the Labour Party has the economy on its side, though, it should run on it. So what I'm waiting for from Keir Starmer is some choices to be made about what he regards as his secondary theme, as well as the economy, in case when Rishi Sunak runs, there's a period where the Conservatives can run on the economy and Labour finds it more difficult. So that's the strategic question they ought to be thinking about. That having been said, I think time for a change would be strong enough for them, even if they don't get the campaign selection of issues right. It's just that will reduce the size of any victory.
So, General, just looking at the YouGov polling on the best party on the economy, if you go back to when Keir Starmer became leader, they're up 3, 4, 5 points, I think, on the economy, maybe a bit more than that, 5, 6, 7 points. But if the Tories have halved, that seems to be the case right across the board, that the Labour Party is nudged up a couple of points, 3, 4, 5 points. But the Tory, the number of people backing the Tories on that any given subject seems to have halved, and that's why Labour now have a lead. So it's not that there's huge now new public faith in the Labour Party. It's just everyone seems to have lost faith with the Conservatives. Miranda, you mentioned the NHS, and it's despite being absolutely miles ahead on the NHS, it's not stopping Keir Starmer returning to it. Let's take a listen. This is him launching a mission to build an NHS fit for the future.
For me, the NHS is personal. My wife works in our local hospital. My sister was a nurse and my mum was a nurse until she became too ill to work, and the NHS, which had been her livelihood, became her lifeline. And so the NHS runs through my family like a stick of rock. That's why my Labour government will train a new generation of doctors and nurses.
The NHS runs through my family like a stick of rock. Just slightly confused me, because I think he means the NHS runs it through like the word Blackpool through a stick of rock rather than like a stick. Anyway, that's a separate point. Every election we have the Labour Party warning there's sort of 24 hours to save the NHS, Miranda. Do they need to still keep banging on about this with the soft piano music and the sense of it being like a religion?
So I'm really pleased you phrased the question that way, because I would really question whether we are still at the stage where the NHSs are, you know, this is our unestablished national religion, as it always used to be described. You know, the one thing that the whole country, no matter your background, no matter your income group, etc., could unite around the principles of the NHS. We probably do still unite around the principles, but public satisfaction with the NHS as they actually experience it day to day has really, really gone down in the last few years. And clearly the COVID crisis exposed the consequences of kind of sticking plaster policies and sticking plaster funding settlements over the last years as well. So I actually am not sure how much, despite that colossal lead on the issue, the Labour Party can just get away with, as you say, the sort of softly, softly Vaseline on the lens emotional appeal to our love for the NHS. I think they actually have to come up with some really concrete ideas as to how it can deliver for patients. And again, I think he's got to be a little bit careful talking too much about the workforce and not talking enough about the patients. And I think that, you know, Wes Streeting, the kind of rising star on the right of the Labour Party, did a very clever thing when he said he wanted to be the shop steward for the users of the NHS, for the patients, because that's actually the thing that matters, is the care. So I think, you know, clearly they can campaign on the NHS because people see it falling apart. It's the most obvious experience of that phrase broken Britain that they are using to hit the government with again and again.
Yeah.
They do actually have to have some solutions to the problem and not just emotion.
What do you think, Danny? Because, I mean, Wes Streeting has been, I mean, he's been sort of very publicly critical of the NHS, because I suppose because he can, because he's Labour's shadow health secretary.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that again if I were Wes Streeting. I think that, actually, I slightly disagree with Miranda, really. First of all, obviously, we do completely agree that it isn't that talking about the NHS with piano music behind it isn't the solution to the problems of the service. And that in office, Labour would need to have more than that. But I'm not sure they would in a campaign. The truth is that people are incredibly loss averse. I just think proposing ways of making changes to the National Health Service is just inviting political rows that Keir Starmer doesn't need. His entire strategy seems to me to be closing down every potential row so that people's general view is it's safe to have a Labour government, and they're willing to wear, and from a strategic point of view should be willing to wear, the fact that people will then say, well, that's a very disappointing offering, because I think that anything, you know, while people in theory want a vision for both the country and for the NHS, in practice, I'm not sure that they do. So talking very hard tax political strategy terms, then I don't think that would be the right advice. Of course, speaking personally, I'm extremely frustrated with the idea that it's impossible to have any kind of reasonable debate about the National Health Service. Like Keir Starmer, I'm, you know, also associated. My wife was used the NHS myself, and my wife was also a doctor, we care about it a lot. But saying that is not enough.
And anyone who starts doing, some of my best friends are nurses. I'm not sure that helps in terms of tackling a problem in a particular area.
Also, Matt, I think the thing is, once you actually kind of are exposed day in, day out to the NHS experience, which unfortunately I have been over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, you know, you realise the underlying problems are really bad. I mean, why do we have worse, such bad cancer outcomes in the UK compared to competitor economies?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't gloss over that with a bunch of rainbow stickers. You know, we should be doing better. And it's structural problems that mean that we aren't, in terms of investment, training, equipment. You know, per head of the population, we have a scandalously low number of scanners even to diagnose, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of conversation I mean, Danny, rather than, you know.
I just want to finally turn our attention to possible reshuffles. Rishi Sunak is going to do some sort of shake-up next week when Ben Wallace will stop being Defence Secretary. Maybe that'll make a difference to the Tory lead on defence. Bigger reset is coming later in the autumn, apparently. Labour will have to have a reshuffle as well. We all get very excited about these things beforehand, Danny. Has there ever been a reshuffle which has dramatically changed the fortunes of a political party?
I think Harold Macmillan famously had a reshuffle that sort of led, in other words, that led people to sort of panic about his leadership. So sometimes it can make the leader in charge look incompetent. In 1981, I think it could be argued that Margaret Thatcher gave her cabinet a sense of direction and ended the squabbling inside the cabinet by making a big political choice. And I would say a similar reshuffle with real consequences was the reshuffle of the shadow cabinet that Keir Starmer carried out, that brought Rachel Reeves in as shadow chancellor. The reason the reason it makes a difference in those cases is because the leader of the party is making a political choice. They're deciding on the direction of their government. If the choice is merely about, in quotes, freshening up the team, replacing one person no one's ever heard of with someone else no one's ever heard of, it makes no difference whatsoever. And Rishi Sunak has to engage in a cabinet reshuffle, partly because Ben Wallace is leaving, but it doesn't seem to me that any other advantage will be gained other than the fact that he has to do it. Unless he makes a big choice, decides he's going to have a substantially more liberal cabinet or a substantially more right-wing cabinet, as Boris Johnson did. Yeah, those reshuffles which may do make a difference to your opinion, but most don't, and this probably won't.
What about you, Miranda? Are you looking forward to updating your reshuffle wall chart?
No, I mean, you know, I agree with Danny. The ones which turn out to be actual purges do seem to make a difference to governments, but anything short of a purge is pretty much window dressing. I'm a bit perplexed by this idea that Sunak's decided he has to remove from the cabinet people who are standing down as an MP, because I would have thought, if, to return to our earlier conversation, what you're trying to demonstrate is maximum available competence from your cabinet in the run-up to an election, yeah, why not keep people in post and then allow the people who want to retain their seats as MPs to go off and campaign? That seems to me a slightly odd set of...
A sort of genuine...
Do you know what I mean? It seems like caretaker. An odd sort of priority
A whole bunch of people saying, we'll look after the place, you go and see if you can hang on to your seats.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, I understand that they've got this kind of accusation now most powerfully being levelled by the disgruntled Nadine Dorries as she exits stage right, you know, of being a zombie government. So maybe they feel some sort of refresh is necessary. But I just think, you know, putting people into cabinet who are then going to be massively distracted by needing to hang on to their marginal, newly dodgy seat is really questionable approach, actually, if what you're trying to do is demonstrate that you've got some sort of grip.
Miranda Green from the FT, and of course Danny Finkelstein from The Times. You can read him in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's The Political Editors.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth, growth, and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. On this episode, Francis Elliott, political editor from 2013, on the demise of the coalition, Theresa May's Brexit years, and how Boris Johnson tried to get first Brexit and then Covid done.
It's a matter of personal regret that I couldn't persuade Ed Miliband to do a leader's interview. Professionally, it was great. Yeah. You know, it sold a lot of papers, kept us in coffee. When she finally decided to go, yeah, I was one of two people that she told. And he's the only person that, and when I came to pay the bill for the lunch, I see that he put 40 Marlboro cigarettes on the bill.
So, Francis Elliott, let's begin at your beginning then as political editor of The Times. You returned having been a foreign correspondent in 2013, and the coalition was a new thing to sort of get your head around, formed 3 years earlier, and by 2013, it was still going.
Well, I'd been there at its formation, just. I was aware of it as a concept. As a reality, yeah. It blew my mind. These people who I had spent a career ignoring...
The Lib Dems.
And you had spent a career cultivating.
Cultivating, and suddenly it all came...
I remember very early on going to a drinks at, I think it was Nick Clegg's Grace and Favour apartment at Admiralty Arch, and the likes of Jeremy Brown were flocking to this new young thing called Matt Jordan. And I was political editor of the Dane. I was very much on my Jack Jones with my warm glass of wine,
yeah.
You know, thinking... Maybe I should have spent more time with the Lib Dems.
But you knew the Tories very well, not least David Cameron.
Yes.
Because you'd written a biography of him.
Written a biography of Dave, yeah.
How did that affect your relationship with him? Because obviously you knew him.
Not brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, I blame Andrew Coulson quite heavily for... It's fair to say that when Coulson came in as his Director of Communications, access to some key sources dried up. And I think Coulson thought that, didn't want that and wanted a sort of separation and separated Cameron and his circle from the few journalists that he was prepared to talk to. So it wasn't great journalistically, but I did still know quite a lot about him and his politics and his milieu. So in some ways it was an odd decision not to be in Parliament through that period.
So explain then your journey through journalism. I've basically been following you. You were at The Independent on Sunday, then I was at The Independent on Sunday, caught up at The Times.
Well, in The Times 2007, late Blair, early Brown, amazing story. The rise of Cameron and falling just short of an overall majority, and amazingly, I think, still one of the most dramatic elections that I covered. And then Phil Webster was replaced by Rowland, and... In about 10 minutes later, I went to Delhi to be the South Asia editor, which is a job I always wanted and was delighted to get, and thought I had left the lobby for good, and then was returned to the colours 3 years later, literally walked across the Wagga border from India to Pakistan, and then picked up the Cameron's mid-trip.
So your return back to the lobby was flying...
Was by Prime Minister's plane, which I think is the way that it should be done.
Presumably, while you were in India, you were watching how politics was unfolding.
Not only watching, but editions of the later editions of the book were coming out.
So there were two things that stick in my mind about your book. There was the drugs,
yeah,
in the first edition, where you revealed that he came very close to being expelled from Eton, and then in the second, when the revised paperback came out, you revealed that he was prone to David Cameron's prone to chillaxing.
A gold medal in chillaxing at the Chequers, like nothing more than a glass of decent red and a bottle of decent red and a yeah.
And you say relations with him weren't that good. Presumably when you left, there was still this expectation that the coalition would collapse at any time.
Yeah.
And it was still going strong in 2013.
Yes, it was. And it was, I mean, in some ways it was the coalition was at its absolute apogee, I would say, at that point.
2.5 years ago, Nick and I put party differences aside to come together in the national interest and form the first coalition government in Britain for over 65 years.
Everything this coalition government has done is there to serve one big purpose, which is to build a stronger economy in a fairer society.
From 2013 to 2015, it became, as the economy turned and started going gangbusters, if you remember that phrase, it was becoming obvious that it wasn't a partnership in any way of equals. We didn't really quite understand the extent to which Cameron and Osborne were plotting to devour their coalition junior partner, but you know, that was what was happening.
Because you had three parties, all sort of neck and neck in terms of the news, if not the polls. You had Team Cameron, Team Clegg and Team Miliband all talking to you, wanting to lunch, wanting to brief stories, wanting to gossip about colleagues. It felt like there was just a lot going on.
There was a lot going on. Funny enough, the paper took a while, I think, to kind of cotton on to how rich those journalistic waters were.
At that point, you were still really filing for the paper rather than the web.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a the web was still a massive inconvenience that you kind of serviced resentfully, as infrequently as you could get away with, yeah. And probably quite badly. Sorry,
everybody. Sorry about that.
How did you feel politics was settling down at that point? Because there was a lot of sort of Guardian think pieces that coalitions were here for to stay forever. And
I don't think I ever thought that. It was quite a painful period in some ways. I mean, you know, Miliband had been, in the sense that, because you're right, because it was such a contested space, and, you know, times matters during elections, right? You know, particularly during elections. And so there was a lot of... Oh, there was a lot of allegations of bad faith, and it was a personally awkward place to be, because you, as Times Pollard, you're, you know, Caesar's wife, you're supposed to be above it, you're supposed to hold the ring, and that becomes very hard when you're in the middle of an election campaign.
These six pledges are now carved in stone. They're carved in stone because they won't be abandoned after the general election.
It's a matter of personal regret that I couldn't persuade Ed Miliband to do a leader's interview, and I think that was the first time that, you know, a main leader hadn't done a leader's interview. That it tells you a bit about the shifting nature of, I mean, although Times Matters, it didn't matter perhaps as much as it used to.
Although maybe if you had done, maybe you'd have swung it.
Well, I suppose it tells, I don't think it was a terribly good idea for them not to do it.
It tells you something about, actually the weird thing is, because I had similar battles, so I was at Mail Online, and Cameron did interviews, I think he did interviews with a couple of times, you know, Ed Balls did, Nick Clegg did, but Miliband wouldn't.
Yeah, he just really wouldn't.
But it tells you something about their approach to, I don't know whether it's risk or the audiences they were trying to speak to, that they wouldn't even speak, like, not the establishment newspaper, or the biggest newspaper website in Britain. A sort of lack of confidence or something.
Yeah, yeah. And if you remember that, that campaign was really so stage managed by Cameron. I mean, they really kind of, they really got it down to a fine art of small, allegedly town halls where they absolutely pack them full of kind of narcs and ask patsy questions and then maybe take two softball questions and bundle us all out.
Taking a risk, having a punt, having a go, that pumps me up, and it's what is changing our country.
That was the sort of high water mark of Lyndon Crosby's. I mean, that must have been his dream come true, and it worked. It absolutely worked.
It was extraordinary that you arrived back, thought, I really need to get to know these Lib Dems. And 2 years later, all that hard work.
Oh, dear. Awful lot of lost lunch receipts, yeah. indeed.
Did you think that was going to happen, that the Conservatives would end up... I mean, even David Cameron seemed a bit surprised he ended up with an overall majority
in
2015.
You know what it's like, Matt. You don't think terribly far into the future. Yeah. It's like, if possibly you think as far as, you know, what am I doing for the Sunday for Monday... Yeah. You try to think round as many corners as you can, but you can't really kind of future cast. So, in truth, I didn't know. I always knew that the coalition was not going to happen again anytime soon, because it was so badly kind of, it went so badly wrong for the smaller party, which had been the lesson of every coalition on the continent, and somehow they managed to convince themselves that, well, it worked out fine for Nick Clegg, right? Yeah. But not so much for his party.
And then 2015, the big electoral shock of our careers was going to be that David Cameron won a majority. And then
so
12 months later, he had to deliver on the thing he didn't think he'd have to deliver on.
So there
an EU referendum.
I did do a little bit of future casting, because he had made this speech in 2013, the famous Bloomberg speech, where he had committed to this and sold the pass on it. He'd convinced, you know, against George Osborne's advice, and Osborne's worries all came true. And you could see, almost from the get-go of that administration, that this was the kind of, you know, this was the spectre that was going to do for him.
And I think we were both in Brussels when he got his deal.
I believe we are stronger, safer and better off inside a reformed European Union. And that is why I'll be campaigning with all my heart and soul to persuade the British people to remain in the reformed European Union that we have secured today.
His emergency break in the middle of the night.
Yes.
And maybe it was because it was all quite late.
Yes.
But I remember feeling a bit queasy about it.
I was literally queasy that day because I had some sort of vile illness. But
maybe that's what was going around. But there was a sense in the middle of the night, this is not enough.
No. And it never was going to be enough. And do you remember it then? It had already leaked in drafts, so we knew what was in it. The text was out there. They couldn't defend it because they said, oh, it's a leak, we never comment on leaks. But everybody was taking
everyone else was shots. Yeah.
And then it's like, ta-da!
And then by the time we got to the campaign, nobody mentioned it again.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, you know.
Were you familiar with Dominic Cummings before the campaign?
I was indeed familiar with Dominic Cummings. I had known Dominic since the Business for Stirling campaign,
oh, yeah,
sometime before. So I'd known him since 1999. And then he had run, with James Frayne, a very successful operation against regional mayors. You know, I knew him as a sort of very smart campaigner. I'm sure he won't mind me telling this story. I remember him first. He had a brief period as IDS's chief of staff.
Oh, of course, in Duncan Smith,
in,
yeah.
In old Smith Square, and I met him for a lunch. And he's the only person that, when I came to pay the bill for the lunch, I see that he put 40 Marlboro cigarettes on the bill.
And he didn't last very long in that, did he? And no, he ended up turning on Ian Duncan Smith and tried to blow him up, mm-hmm, which, you know, anyone who went anywhere near him again in the future
it
might have learned
there.
That lesson.
Absolutely all there, you know.
And what about Boris Johnson? I mean, he clearly then is the, from having been this sort of lovable guy on a zip wire character, it, for the first time, really had to pick a side when he decided to go for leave. Yeah. And was then just on this mad roller coaster, which only ended really a few weeks ago.
Ooh, where do we start with him? One of the more, I need to keep on meaning to dig out, one of the more embarrassing intros I think I ever wrote was when.
That's a feature in itself.
Well, indeed. although it was a good, I think it was still a good intro on its own terms, but it was wrong. He had been sacked for lying about the Petronella Wyatt affair, was on the backbenchers. They were scrambling around for a candidate for London Mayor. Cameron had wanted Nick Bowles to do it. Nick Bowles, I think, had cancer. There were a couple of other candidates that let him down. And so I wrote something like, the twin farces of Boris Johnson and the Tories' search for a London Mayor candidate collided yesterday as blah, 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 blah. But obviously, as we know, he got the gig. Yeah. He was the most powerful elected Tory, you know, politician. He was the pin-up boy. He was the myth was born. I've already written his political obituary three times.
Fully expect to write it again. Yes, exactly, it'll be written off again. We should, I feel obliged as part of this process, we should talk about Theresa May, although I'm very conscious that you and I worked together. It's probably the point where we were working together most closely. I was writing Red Box, you were the pollhead of the Times. The period 2016 to 2019,
yes,
was so grueling,
yes,
and so miserable, so relentless, and so totally
pointless. It's a therapy session, Matt, you and I.
By the end of it, by the time she left, we were no further forwards on any of the big, meaningful questions.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
It was a horrible gig, and then as soon as the results dropped for 2017, you know, exquisitely bad for her, for Britain, for the negotiation. Elections don't always clear the air, like, make things much, much worse, and that one certainly did.
And yet on and on she went for 2 years.
On and on she went, when it was like, you know, both legs were shot off.
But and all of that stuff, the Swire Amendment and the Malthouse Compromise and the meaningful votes.
Too soon.
The Saturday sitting. Where we all trooped in on a Saturday, the first time since the outbreak of the Falklands.
Fourth, this may be for the convenience of the House to know, although the second motion is debatable, I think it will be convenient for the two motions to be debated together so that reference to the second motion may be made in the debate, and if the second motion is moved, I will put the question or questions on that motion without separate debate. Order. Statement, the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, I want to begin by echoing what you've just said. My gratitude to all members of the House for assembling on a Saturday for the first time in 37 years.
And then we all went home again, nothing having been resolved.
Obviously meaningful votes, but then indicative votes.
Indicative votes.
Yeah, Norway, all that huge kind of nomenclature of nonsense.
And nothing happened.
Yeah. What, people got cross, that's what happened. People got sat at home and just got sick to death of hearing about it.
And actually, it sort of radicalised people.
I think
who
it did.
Weren't that bothered about politics.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing.
No. Definitely not. Well, no.
I mean, it's good if people are interested in politics.
Professionally, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, it sold a lot of papers, kept us in coffee, which we needed a lot of.
Which we did need a lot of. And also during that period as well, we also had the phenomenon of Jeremy Corbyn.
huge high of 2017 from his perspective, followed by the worst result for 85 years. Yes. Of all the things that you've covered in your political career, where does Jeremy Corbyn rank?
After leader speeches in party conference, the chief spin doctor will come down to the press floor and there's an almighty bun fight and everybody huddles around to hear the kind of briefing on the speech. You know, when X said, you know, Y, what he actually meant was Z, and then we all write up, Z! So, you know, it's a quite important point of the journalistic process and a high watermark. So Jeremy Corbyn's first big speech.
We need to be investing in skills, investing in our young people. And, strong message here, not cutting student numbers.
Seamus Milne, his spin doctor, comes down and we ask him about one line, I can't remember what it was, and I just said, Seamus, does Jeremy Corbyn believe in a market economy? No, I wouldn't say that. So there is no sort of room for capitalism in the UK. Okay, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is like, you know, so the frame was just so completely different. It's almost like you never got to first base with him or his team because there was nothing to, you know, there was no lock. And so while some of the reporting of him was unfair, some of it was gentle because we underplayed how absolutely radical or kind of like non-mainstream he was in his thinking.
And what about the anti-Semitism question?
Well, I'm proud of what we did with that. I mean, Lucy Fisher, Henry Zeffman, Laura, we did a good job of reporting that awful story, I think. And I'm pleased about that. And I'm proud of that. And I'm proud of the team for what we did. You know, it was so easy to get wrong, but we didn't get it wrong. So, you know, we did it properly, early, well.
I've just realised that you're the political editor of Change UK.
No?
That
seismic moment in British.
What an extraordinary weird time that was.
Yeah.
Just which next? Was Anna Soubry joining?
Yeah.
You know, Anna Soubry aside, actually, just lots of people we'd never really bothered speaking to before. Yeah. Suddenly political rock stars for 10 minutes. And then it was all over. So then we get to 2019 then. There's just the misery of Brexit votes and crunch moments that came and went with nothing happening. Illegal prorogation and all of that.
When the Royal Commissioners walked into the House of Lords, it was as if they had walked in with a blank sheet of paper. The prorogation was also void and of no effect. Parliament has not been prorogued.
Parliament just wouldn't vote to dissolve itself, right? And there was nothing Johnson could do about it. And I mean, you know, I'm no Cummings fanboy, but it is the case that I remember having a coffee with Cummings. I said, look, Dom, it's not happening for you. You know, they're just going to hold him there and boil him alive in all this. And pretty soon the Brexit isn't going to get done and he's going to get blamed for it and you're going to get your legs broken. And he said, no, we're just going to keep on doing it. I said, well, you know, you've done it three times. Nobody's voting. Surely nobody's stupid enough to actually vote for this. Step forward, the late unlamented leader of the Lib Dems at the time.
Joe Swinson
and the SNP eventually took the bait, and the rest is history. So, there is an alternative history where everybody, all the other opposition parties hold their nerve, and that election is not in court and in that frame. Because it was obvious as soon as you put that frame on.
Let's get Brexit done, my friends, and get on with our project of sensible, moderate, but tax cutting, one nation conservative.
Get Brexit done is one of the most inspired pieces of political messaging.
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, but it appealed to everyone, apart from ultra-hardcore EU beret-wearing Lib Dems who wanted us to rejoin tomorrow.
That's most of your listeners.
Everyone else.
I thought that was most of your.
But everyone else, all the remainers, most remainers who just said, look, well, I think we should have stayed, but now we've voted, we should leave. Just get it over with.
Stay at home, exactly. I
mean, just get it done.
Yeah.
Stop talking about it. And then the sort of the last chapter of your multi-chaptered story is followed. Is COVID.
Yeah, that's a miserable way to end, really.
Yeah. But a way that quite often people would accuse political journalists of over-egging the significance of their stories. And yet actually, for the first time, it was a real life and death story that we were reporting on every day.
You hang around these kind of government spin doctors for long enough to be able to read their body language. And as the months of early 2020 progressed, it became very noticeable
that the James Slack, you know, he looked really haunted.
He was what by then director of communications.
Director of communications for Johnson had done the same job under May. Obviously, a key source if you're part of the Times, and without kind of like you might want to stock up on, you know, bog roll, you started to get the vibes. And I remember coming back one day and saying to my wife, I said, "This is like, I think this is this whole COVID thing is like a lot more serious than they're letting on." And she said, "Oh, we should stock up." I said, "Don't be ridiculous. What are we going to do? Chuck the, you know, tins of baked beans at the zombies as they come over there?" Yeah. Anyway, that's something that has been held against me.
So. Well, I remember I came into this building, into the news building, to have photos done for the Times Radio, which is imminent launch. And it was like a beautiful sunny day. And I thought, well, I might go over to Westminster. I thought, oh, no, I won't. I'll go to Westminster tomorrow. And I didn't come into London for 3 months. You just felt it slipping, and then it all happened at once.
Lovely Chris Smythe, the Whitehall editor. I remember switching the lights out at the Times room. Chris really was much further ahead down the mental journey on COVID because he had been a former health editor, said, "Oh, we won't be seeing this for a while. The next time, there'll be creepers growing up the walls," he said. But he wasn't far.
Well, of course, Chris's story is brilliant because he was the health editor of the Times for years and moved to the lobby to get away from health stories and ended up becoming essentially COVID editor.
COVID editor for 3 years, 2.5 years,
I urge you, at this moment of national emergency, to stay at home, protect our NHS, and save lives.
When did you decide you wanted to do something else?
Yeah, the truth of the matter is I had made myself a promise at the height of the Brexit, all that misery, that I was never doing this again. You know, I just reached a point in my life where, you know, to do that job is, it's a huge privilege and a massive honour and all that of it, but it is at least 12 hours a day of being switched on, thinking about nothing other than politics. And that became 16 hours a day during Brexit. And I think, you know, I think the pandemic put a spoke in a lot of wheels and just thought, you know.
And in terms of your relationships with those people over time, you know, the highs and the lows, and like you said, being the political editor gives you access and people want to speak to you. Did you get on with the various many prime ministers that you covered during your period?
Of highs and lows. I mean, funnily enough, the one that I probably did weirdly. So my relationship with David Cameron was complicated by the fact that, you know, I'd written the book. It's the bits of it he didn't like, but he knew that I knew. If anybody was going to explain his political journey, you know, it was James Hanning and I, because we'd done it, right?
Yeah.
But we were never, you know, he never had me in for cosy chats. None of them ever did, right? But the one, funnily enough, I didn't have a relationship with her, but Theresa May was good to me. She was all right, you know. You know, there are little things like I got a question at the Donald Trump presser, which you know, is really in her gift.
And we'll have no problem with that, okay?
Francis.
Mr. President, Francis Elliott from The Times. Do you agree with your ambassador that the entire economy needs to be on the table in a future trade deal, including the NHS?
Look, I think everything with a trade deal is on the table. When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else, or a lot more than that, but everything will be on the table, absolutely.
I'm proud of that. I'm proud of getting him to say that the NHS was on the table. And when she went, when she finally decided to go, you know, I was one of two people that she told. I think history will be reasonably kind to her because I think that it is obvious that there was little else she could do. And she was trying to stop this country from making a historic mistake. And failing.
Future pollets will report on whether or not she was right.
Yes.
Well, Francis Elliott, thank you so much for joining us. This trip down memory lane for the political editors on Times.
One day we'll do the real story.
Yeah. I'll stop recording.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode. We will have the final political editors interview tomorrow with Stephen Swinford, the current political editor, lifting the lid on Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and where politics goes next. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health
right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.